Welcome, everybody, to the Eyes on Big podcast, your go-to Big Ten football podcast, brought to you by the Amador Whiskey Company. I'm your co-host, Jeffrey the Greek, typically joined by Big Kurt or Jordan Eggleston, but neither could make this podcast, so I could focus solely on one of my favorite interviews that we do about this time every year. From Fantasy Pro Sports and Betting Pros, we now have NFL draft guru Thor Nystrom joining the Eyes on Big podcast. Thor, how the heck are you doing this fine Saturday?
I'm doing well. Always good to talk to Jeffrey the Greek. Good to be back.
Are you ready? What percentage would you give that you are ready to do this interview right now?
I'm 100% ready for the interview. As far as like the draft work overall, I feel like I'm like, you know, we're 4 weeks.
Yep.
I guess we're 4 weeks minus OM. 2 days from round one. Yep. I feel like 75%, okay. 75%. You know, I still need to get over that last 25-30% sure. of the class, but I feel good about where I'm at, like the progress. So it's just like, you know, it's like the Iditarod. You just,
yes.
You don't win it in one day. You just need to keep the pace.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And what I was unsuccessfully trying to get at there was our 1000% joke, making that an annual part of the podcast, but
even 1000%,
even at 75%, you're still way ahead of me and anybody listening to the podcast. All right. So we'll jump right in here. I've got two questions to start out with, two topics, if you will. These are a little bit more at the 10,000 foot view for NFL draft. And then obviously we'll dive into specifics to Big Ten football players in the draft. That'll be our focus here for our obvious Big Ten football podcast. So the first one, though, like I said, 10,000 foot question. The topic would be film or fast, okay? What I'm getting at is I wonder if you can give me a little bit of insight, give our listeners a little bit of insight on what most of these general managers and coaches are thinking. These are football guys, right? Even if you're an owner, you don't buy a football team, I think, unless you're a football guy. Coaches that we know are general managers. What I'm getting at is when film is so good on somebody, right? A little bit undersized, a little bit slow. I think of a linebacker, but constantly making plays. Where are these draft, the people that can actually select the human beings in the draft? Where are they compared to the fast? And of course, then I'm talking about the underwear Olympics where you see guys pop up. Now, I'm not saying being fast and freakishly strong is not important to being a football player, but have we gotten to the point where they're not letting that poison their brain from what they're seeing on film?
Yeah, I mean, what you're hitting on, it's why the draft process is so fun and stacking these boards is so fun. It's because this thing is not science, it's an art. There is no equation to, you know, where we can quantify and say for sure, this guy for sure is number one, this guy for sure number two, and then all the way down to 500. There's so much data on these guys, even when you separate that from, you know, it's even statistical stuff on the field, then you have their analytical profile, then of course you have their film, and then everyone, there's guys where two different guys, they're going to see the film the same way. There's also guys where two guys, they could be in football for the past 50 years. They will be watching the same film shoulder to shoulder. They will see it totally different. An example in this class of that would be Keon Coleman. You'll get guys watching the same thing at Keon Coleman. They'll be arguing until they're blue in the face about what they just saw. But yeah, it's, you have all these different things and then you have to bake it in. You also have to unspool those things from the context where they occurred, right? Like I've had these discussions with guys that worked at Baseball Prospectus. I remember a conversation I had, one of my buddies that worked there like 7-8 years ago, one of the guys that helped put together their preseason top 101 prospects or whatever. And I was telling him, I was like, you got the hardest job in sports, man. Like you have to decide if a 17-year-old coming over from the Dominican Republic, if he's better at, you know, is he going to be better in 5 years than, you know, this guy who's in single A Staten Island, you know, and or is he better than the shortstop? Like all this different stuff. And the guy was like, no. Your job is way harder. He's like, in my job, baseball is an individual sport that is masquerading as a team sport. In football, it is impossible to unspool the context. And that's totally true. So, like, I mean, that's why we spend so much time on the film, then on the analytics, looking into the historical data as far as the athletic profiles and what we've seen, you know, of that type. coming into the NFL. And then each individual person, then they have to do that equation for themselves. That's where the art of it comes in. And you stack your board and then you argue with the people in the building or your buddies or other people in your industry.
So I guess I kind of made the error of just assuming that film that looks good for one guy is going to look good for all. That's obviously not the case. And what you got me thinking is there would be differences in film of somebody that made plays consistently at a lower level of college, as opposed to somebody that played, you know, if I could, in the Big Ten or SEC. So certainly I get that, but I guess I'm the production, you know, like if somebody is just constantly around the ball making plays, maybe not so much a wide receiver or cornerback, as you obviously need the physical speed to be able to compete on the edges like that. It's just something I always think about, Thor, is, you know, they're going to not draft a guy because he's a little bit shorter, but then he winds up going in the later rounds and he makes plays gasp, you know, at the NFL level, just like he did at the college level. I feel like you see it somewhat commonly. I'm not saying all the time, but pretty commonly.
For sure. Yeah. And on defense, there's less of that, but there is some. For instance, a guy near and dear to our heart, there's arguments about this that has to do with the context. Cooper DeJean coming in, right? Like, because Iowa plays the predominantly zone coverage scheme. So it's like, well, you know, I know he was good in that, but could he be a man coverage guy? Could he be effective at that on the boundary in the NFL? And then you have to extrapolate from a limited sample size of snaps, different stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, your point's well taken with that. If you were going to, you know, it is case by case basis for sure. And the way you drive these different things. But to me, the tape and the stuff you did on film, of course, that is the most important thing. The thing I always say is, like, the most valuable data set that you have about any of these prospects, like if it was a pie chart, the biggest piece of pie is your last season of college football.
Yeah.
Right. So like that's a restart. And then it's like the rest of it, you start to fill in with the other stuff. But like, if you were terrible your last year at college,
gonna hurt.
Like you better have some really good contextual reasons to explain why. And then the pie of the rest of the thing better look really good.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Next 10,000 foot question relating NFL draft to business. Okay. Any economist will tell you that the best way to cheapen a product is to flood the market with that product to bring the value down. Are we getting there with wide receivers a little bit, where it just seems like every draft now there are five wide receivers that wind up being good? This isn't besmirching the wide receivers, but if every NFL team essentially has two really good wide receivers, you no longer are special. Are we getting there? Is there any chatter on this, or am I just making this up in my head?
Well, it's, you know, obviously it's a manifestation of the more spread offenses in college. So more guys that would, you know, in the past have played a different position. Now you're playing receiver, and then the NFL is going a little bit more to that. But yeah, I mean, you know, you could certainly argue that there's a bit of maybe oversaturation of that market. I think because of that position has become more important, you know, whether in reality, certainly in public import, whatnot, you definitely get in perception during the draft season. You find that people in the public, they glom onto randos that, like, sometimes I really don't understand. But then sometimes they sleep on other dudes where it's like, well, maybe you should have that dude flipped and stuff like that. But your point is well taken. The evolution of any sport, and this is sort of where we're going, the speed and space game, it also opens up opportunities to potentially get competitive advantages by deviating the other way, which is one reason why I'm super excited that Jim Harbaugh is going back to the NFL and he's going to try to win a championship the way he just did with Michigan, of like, screw that. We're going to build the best offensive line we can. We're going to have two tight ends on the field at all times. We'll block two receivers. They might not be the best ones. We're not going to throw the ball a ton, and we're going to try to bully you.
Yeah, we'll see if those cornerbacks that we have to have to guard those wide receivers want to come up and hit you by the middle of the third quarter.
Exactly.
It's extremely intriguing. We'll stay
with the wide. You're going up against these defenses that have been constructed to defend the spread offenses. So it's, you're zigging when they're zagging.
I mean, that's the history of of the sport of football, the NFL, college, or whatever, you adjust one way, somebody adjusts back. That's one of the beauties of the sport that I hope continues on. Staying in the wide receivers, now we'll get kind of specific to this draft. After talking a little junk about wide receivers, there is a chance that there's a couple guys that are extremely talented. Where do you stand with Marvin Harrison Jr.? My podcast partner Kurt said Bears don't ever overthink it, just take him number one over their quarterback needs. Now, this was before the trades and everything happened. Do you think Marvin Harrison Jr. is number one? Is he number 1A? Where would you have him with the rest of the wide receivers in this class?
Definitely wide receiver one. Yeah, it's I just think of him as like the gift from the receiver gods. I think it's so cool that his dad came in and he had to learn all those tricks of the trade. You know, it's like, what was that movie where was it American Pie, where the older brother, he tells his brother he's got to go to the library and push the books aside, and then he finds like that old ancient, book that has all the secrets of sex or whatever. You know, they're in high school, and then he's like, whatever. But that
But can I
Marvin,
just, that was
yeah,
American Pie,
American
very
Pie.
much different than American Beauty.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Yeah. All right. But yeah, American Pie. But that was Marvin Harrison Sr. That was the only way that he was going to excel in the NFL, because obviously, he was stick thin. But then his son comes out and got all the physical attributes that he didn't, right? He's stretched out, he is well built, he has the wingspan of a pterodactyl, but he also then passed along everything he learned in his ancient text. So I mean, he's just a stud. I don't know if you've seen the thing that Matt Harmon put out with his charting of Harrison. I thought it was so interesting. It was the reception perception, Matt Harmon. He said some like in his charting, the history of it, Marvin Harrison was double teamed on something like double the rate of anyone else that Harmon had ever charted. And yet his success rate on those was like, easily the best of the sample size. So it was like, and then last year, prior to that, you could be like, oh, well, he was playing with one of the better ball placer guys that came out of college football last 3, 4 years. Let's just say Kyle McCord does not qualify pretty close to that. They told Kyle McCord after the season, you get going. And then he went off to Syracuse, but he was forcing a lot of disadvantageous targets at Marvin Harrison. Marvin Harrison was figuring it out. He is quarterback proof, he is scheme proof, and even he is double team proof.
And that's what I was quite, you already beat me to the next question I was going to ask you is the production of Marvin Harrison Jr. has been great the last 2 years. Did he actually help himself out with poor quarterback play? Because it was
Thousand percent.
pretty okay, because it was pretty obvious to us watching the game that at some point Ryan Day just it was just throw the ball up to Marvin Harrison
He'll make
on
a
third and
play.
long. And he still made plays, double teams, whatever. I think the so it sounds like you are firm. It is a hard one for Marvin Harrison Jr. And then I'm guessing into the Malik Nabers, Rome Odunze after that.
Yeah, and there, so you have Marvin Harrison Jr., then you have small tier break, because the next two guys we're talking about would have been wide receiver one in a lot of classes last 5, 6 years. It's just that Harrison Jr. happens to be in this one. But both those guys, Nabers and Odunze, have ridiculous tape. They have ridiculous analytical profiles, production profiles. And then they both went out, and now I really appreciated Nabers doing the pro day thing. I would love to know if he only tested because Odunze did what he did at the combine. Odunze tested as a 99th percentile athlete at the combine. If Nabers was like, I better go out and test so that I can be wide receiver two. But then he goes out and proves he probably didn't need to prove it to us to watch LSU last year, but he proved that he is that flying Ferrari that we saw on the field. Those guys, I go back and forth. I know that there's people that are like, oh, it could be Nabers over Harrison. That's not the debate for me. The debate for me, it's Nabers against Odunze. I do have Nabers two right now, but there are days where I'm like, yeah, I love Odunze a ton. So, but I will probably end up with Nabers at two. But those guys for me are very close.
It's a hard one, very close, two and three at wide receivers. Very interesting. Of course, we can't have a draft talk without the next position talk. But I do find quarterbacks interesting this year. Now, here's my take. I don't dislike any of these quarterbacks. I just don't trust any of them. All right. So we'll start with Caleb Williams. I mean, it seems like it's a foregone conclusion that he's going to go number one to Chicago. I'd be lying if I didn't say the fact that he's just simply going to Chicago is why I don't trust him. But there's character issues. There's things I've seen that I can make my own, thought process without digging too deep into it. That there's warning flags on if he's going to be a guy that is a leader of an organization. What say you about not Big Ten quarterback Caleb Williams, but next year USC is in a Big Ten, so I guess it's kind of close. But what's your thoughts on Caleb?
Yeah, so I'll say from the get, he is my quarterback one. He will be the number one guy on my board. But that is an acknowledgement of his ceiling, which I think anyone that has watched him, you have to acknowledge at the peak of that guy's powers, it is damn near impossible to defend him. But you're sort of talking about the elevated risk profile. That I would agree with as well. And I don't think it's been talked about enough. My thing, I try not to do as much of the like the personality stuff because I don't know him. It's tough to extrapolate, but I think that there's some on-field things that you can point to, and so I'm gonna tell you what my concern is about him. A lot of the stuff with him, it centers on the high pressure to sack ratio. So last season, he had the highest pressure to sack ratio of my top 20 quarterbacks in this class. It was 23.2%. The year before it was solid. It was 16%. That's absolutely workable. That was, of course, the year that he won the Heisman. Year before, he was awesome under pressure, 85.1 PFF grade. Last season was horrific, 41.6. And people will just be like, oh, well, the offensive line was
On.
terrible and he lost Addison. But it's like he got to work with a
Yeah, pretty good.
What top 25 overall receiver the year before in a Lincoln Riley offense against a terrible strength of schedule. We're like, that wasn't a good scenario, at least. We're only gonna say it the other way. But here's where the rubber meets the road for me. It's scary for me, a guy that takes that long to throw. Caleb Williams loves to scramble around, extend plays behind the line, and do the playground thing, right? Last year, let's see. He was da, 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 da. Well, let me say first, last year, and I'm sorry, Bears fans, but Justin Fields led the NFL 3.39 average seconds to throw per whatever drop back. Caleb Williams in that awesome 2022 year where he was at the peak of his powers with the Heisman, 3.44 seconds, average seconds to throw. Last year, when there was this statistical regression, you give him a little bit of the benefit of the doubt. He had improved that to 3.16. That was still the second highest in this class, and it was only 1/100th of a second better than the worst one, which was UTEP's Gavin Hardison. A guy, Gavin Hardison, absolutely has an NFL arm, but he reads the field like it's covered in Sanskrit. That's the guy who Caleb Williams is analogous to in terms of getting. Now, they get there in different ways, of course. Caleb Williams is doing this intentionally, but here is where, again, the rubber meets the road. The other issue with Caleb Williams, and I don't know if this is an issue or not, it's just something that we didn't see. In the NFL, you have to do not only timing concepts, which has been discussed a bit, vis-a-vis Caleb Williams, but you have to do the anticipatory throw thing, right? You have to, stand there in the pocket. You have to know the timing. And right before the receiver break, you have to know the exact depth of the field that dude is breaking, the angle he's going to break it at. And you need to place that ball where he is going to be before he even breaks. So the second he turns around, his hands are up, that ball is right there. That's something that's difficult to do. It's not just about arm talent difference. You're talking more about timing and work with the receiver, and you're talking more like watchmaker stuff. That is the opposite of Caleb Williams's game. And it's not only that, he literally did not do it in college. Now, you could look at this two different ways. The favorable way to Caleb Williams would be, well, he was the most talented player on every field he went on. Lincoln Riley clearly was just letting him off the leash, and they had that playground style thing and scramble around, and it's hard to get him in the backfield, and we'll let the receivers routes develop, get downfield, and he's got that bazooka and he could throw on the run. But there is this small percentage that Caleb Williams busts And it has nothing to do with his personality. It has to do with this on-field thing. And nobody discusses this, but here is where it would happen. We haven't seen the anticipatory throwing thing. We haven't seen the timing thing. We've only seen that scramble around thing. If Caleb Williams in college was doing the scramble around thing because he is not capable of standing in the pocket and being the timing anticipatory throw guy, he will bust in the NFL. He needs to at least show NFL defenses. You know, it's like a pitcher in Major League Baseball. If you're coming out of college and you can throw the ball 104 miles per hour and then you have one curveball, I guarantee you your ERA is going to be 1.5 and you're going to get drafted right at the top of the draft. If you don't develop a third, maybe even a fourth pitch in the next level, at best you're going to be a reliever. You will never be a starting pitcher. It's the same thing with Caleb Williams. You need something, if nothing else, to keep the defense off of, okay, the guy's just going to scramble around again. And you know what I mean? Like they have to be concerned that, okay. And even a spacing thing, right? Like JJ McCarthy and Drake May are two guys that attack the middle of the field. We know that the NFL and specifically certain coaches, KOC is an example of this, but in general, the NFL attacks that middle sector of the field way more than in college. And one of the reasons you do it, it's for the spatial thing, because now the defense has to defend that as well. That's how you open up some one-on-one shots downfield. If Caleb Williams does not prove to defenses, I will take free lunch money on those 7-yard outs. If you aren't protecting the middle sector of the field, they're not going to delineate resources there. Well, now guess what? Caleb Williams, you get a spy every play and we get two deep safeties every play. Have fun with your playground stuff. That's where Caleb Williams is going to start to get frustrated. And I think that's when his game could begin to devolve. It's not something we know for sure that he can't do. It's just something that he hasn't done. Theoretically, is teachable, but yeah.
Speaking of anticipating things, my guy Thor anticipated J.J. McCarthy being drafted much higher than the original gurus and draft things that went out. What are you seeing in Michigan's J.J. McCarthy? The production statistics haven't been great. However, boy, did he win games. And there's the thought process that the reason he didn't have the big stats is because that's what he wasn't looked to do that in the Jim Harbaugh style of offense. The talent is undeniable though. So where are you thinking how high could he wind up going? What do you like about JJ or dislike?
Yeah. The only reason I was like out ahead of that one is just, you know, we watch college football real close, right? Like, again, look, in 2022, coming out of that year, I was with everybody else at JJ McCarthy, right? Like, I mean, you know, former five-star, you saw the arm talent, you knew he was a good athlete. There was the tools there, but he was making too many mistakes. He locked on to first reads. You saw different stuff like that. So it's like, that is a developmental guy, right? Like if, you know, right in this moment. But and early on in the season, you know, nothing had really changed my opinion. It was down on the stretch there where it was like, oh boy, like he started to take off late October and then into November, and then certainly college football playoff, Big Ten title game, college football playoff, where they absolutely would not have beaten Alabama without JJ McCarthy. In fact, they wouldn't have made overtime without JJ McCarthy in that game. They probably would have lost by double digits. The people that are like, oh, you know, they with anyone else they would have won. It's like, okay, you weren't watching the games. He, you know, the guy he had become there by the end of that season, the latter half of that season, that is a guy that typically goes in the top 10, former five-star recruit. You know, he has the awesome arm that was confirmed at the combine. He was 1 mile per hour beneath the record for max velocity throw at the NFL combine. No, he's a stud athlete. Unfortunately, he didn't run. We had pretty reliable reports. It was either going to be high 4.4s, low 4.5s. If he didn't, what we did get to see was the 3-cone. He weighed in 17 pounds heavier and he was on his Michigan bio and then ran the 6th fastest 3-cone at the entire NFL combine, irregardless of position. The thing I like about his projection to the NFL where it gets exciting is there are guys who have strong arms and are good athletes as well, where those two things do not marry on the field. Couple examples of this in this class: Joe Milton, the guy who got benched for the guy who got benched for JJ McCarthy once upon a time. Big Ten fans, you know, we'll recall that a while ago. Another good example of this higher profile in this class is Michael Penix, Michael Penix went out and proved I'm still a good athlete, even after all those injuries. But Michael Penix stinks at throwing on the run. In fact, Michael Penix stinks, like his accuracy will go down even if his feet are shuffling. He's an assassin when those feet are glued to the ground.
Yep.
But yeah, when you can push him off his spot, any, that's where it starts to depreciate. JJ McCarthy is different in that he gets almost more dangerous when he is on the move. He's a guy that keeps his mechanics with him wherever he goes, keeps the upper body cocked to throw, eyes downfield with that throwing platform beneath him. He doesn't have like the crazy legs and different stuff like that. He's always got the shoulders squared up and he's looking downfield. And then he has the good sense of the pass rushers around him, but with the peripheral vision. And so he sort of maneuvers around. And then if it's finally not there, he'll steal 10 yards from you really quick. He's the best. Him and Caleb are the two best in this class, throwing on the run outside of the pocket. Under pressure, JJ McCarthy is the best in this class. JJ McCarthy or Drake May is the best at throwing over the middle by the numbers. JJ McCarthy is the best in this class in high leverage situations. There's no debate about that. Third and long situations, third down in general. I think that is super important and notable in this case, because the people, you know, they bring up the volume stats with JJ McCarthy as an aspersion. They neglect to mention that Michigan had 21 plus point leads in 11 right. of their 15 yep. games last year. And that JJ McCarthy didn't take one fourth quarter snap in seven of those games. Huge. He barely threw any passes in yep. the fourth quarter. And he certainly wasn't throwing screen passes to Troy Franklin, who was up against a cornerback that's going to be an accountant in 2 years on, mm-hmm. on first down every right. single time and getting all this yak yardage, whatever. It was handoff to Blake Corum. When I throw, it's these high leverage situations where I need to beat NFL defenders. JJ McCarthy played the best aggregate defensive strength of any of these top quarterbacks, number 38 last year. For example, Bo Nix and Oregon played the 80th average defensive strength last year. JJ McCarthy had to beat NFL defenders in high leverage situations with NFL concepts, and his weapons were not as good as Bo Nix or Michael Penix, or he didn't have a Jordan Addison. He didn't have a Roma Dunze, right? He didn't have a Malik Nabers or a Brian Thomas. Loveland's good. You know, Roman Wilson is probably going to be a high third round pick. Corum is a good runner, but not a great receiver. But you know, defenses knew what was coming invariably when JJ McCarthy went back to throw, and they couldn't stop it anyway. So there's a lot of, and he's early on the developmental right. curve is the last thing I'll say. He won the national title as a 20-year-old for an NFL head coach that believes he should be the first overall pick. JJ McCarthy just turned 21. So I think you can project a whole lot Probably going forward for a kid that's accurate, the good arm, the good athlete, et cetera.
So speaking of a name you just gave, the running back class is not looked on very, very favorably this year. I do like Blake Corum. I think he's amazing between the tackles. His vision, I believe, seems to be off the charts. Maybe doesn't have breakaway speed, but he can get you that first 5 yards, which I think is huge in the NFL. When is the first running back going to come off the board? And do you think it will be Blake Corum? How do you feel about him?
So if they put out, I don't know if they put this out. So maybe someone in the audience is going to be like, they've already put that out. Like, I'm not really sure. If they put out a prop of if there will be a running back taken in the second round, I would bet yes.
Okay.
The running back class has been poo-pooed quite a bit, but the top couple guys I think are worthy of a selection late in the second round. And there's a couple prime spots back there of teams that desperately need a running back to step in right away. And I have it on good authority, at least one of them is kicking the tires real hard on these kids. And, well, the Dallas Cowboys, they're sitting there at the end of the second round. They desperately need a running back, and they are doing deep work on those guys at the top there. Will they be able to defer that need till the third round? They'll probably see, you know, what happens in front of them and different stuff like that. But they're definitely doing that. As far as Corum goes, as a Big Ten pod, I'm gonna toss a super scandalous take at you, and I don't know what you or the Big Ten listeners out there are gonna think of this. I like Corum enough. I rank him number six, maybe a little bit lower than some, but maybe slightly higher than some who hate him. I do not have Blake Corum as my highest rated Big Ten running back, Ooh. Which that is probably the scandalous take. I have a guy ranked one spot ahead of him, and before I even say this, This is a guy who you and I watch plenty of early in his career, and I love the athleticism. But I want to say, coming into this process, I had not watched a lot of this guy live last. I caught a couple of his games because the team is. I'm talking about Tyrone Tracy.
Yeah.
The team was terrible. When I went into his tape, I went in with the eyes wide open. Like it wasn't like I was like, oh, I want to fall in love with Tracy. I had seen his analytical profile from last year, which is pretty crazy with the explosive runs and the broken tackles and stuff. But you never know how that was accrued. He opened my eyes watching his tape. That dude as a runner is super duper bouncy. He's juiced up and he has way better vision and feel than I would have thought for a guy that is new to that position. They also misused the hell out of him as a receiver. It was just an offense that lacked creativity.
And that's what I say. I don't want to 100% speak on fact, but Iowa wanted him running back for a while there. I mean, they had moved him into a spot like that almost immediately after getting to Purdue with the new coaches. Certainly, they're like, listen, you're a running back. You know what I mean? Like, he's lucky coaches stuck on him that long, because if he would have stayed extremely stubborn to never put that film on, finally, somewhat his junior year, but really his last year, good for him that he was able to get it. And his testing would blew my mind. How quick and fast.
He was insane.
Yes, he was insane with the
98th percentile athlete.
Insane. A couple quick hitters since I know we're running out of time. Penn State left tackle Olofoshado.
I'm a little bit lower on him. This is one where it was the opposite when I got into his tape. There's a couple concerning things for me with him. The things that I like are he's got the light feet out there on the boundary, and I like his feel for pass blocking. So I understand why people like him. The things I don't like is he categorically lacks play strength, and he stinks as a run blocker. So those are a couple of things. Then the I talk about historical data points and different stuff like that. For Sean, let me pull him up in my database. Arm length was 8.5. Which is red flag territory. The arm length for offensive tackles is something that is statistically significant. And then his hand size is small too, which maybe not quite as much. But between the lack of reach, which, and some people are like, who cares about that? I'll tell you who does. The UFC puts reach out there for a reason.
Yep.
The guy who gets to touch the other dude first in any interaction, any athletic endeavor, they get it's like leading the dance, right? It doesn't mean that you're going to win the interaction. It just means that you get to inform the beginning of it. And since Mr. Fashanu also lacks the play strength, when you're projecting him to the next level, it's like the other dude's always going to get his hands on him first. He's going to be more powerful too. Does it mean that he's, you know... So that's, I don't hate him, but as far as how he at least initially was viewed and how some people still view him as like the top 10 guy or top 12, I just don't see him like that. To me, he is more of a late first round type fella. I have him offensive tackle 6 in this class. If you include Fatanu as a tackle, which I do, I have Fashanu 6, like one spot ahead of Jordan Morgan, 2 spots ahead of the kid from BYU, you know, for instance.
Wow. How about Illinois defensive tackle Jerzan Johnny Newton?
Yeah, him and Murphy, I go back and forth with. I think I'll probably end up going with Murphy, but that's another one where those guys, it's like, you know, like I was talking about with the Dunze and Neighbors, it's like depending on the day. Newton, I've appreciated his game for so long. Murphy last year was where he started to bump up against them. And that's where the debate comes. And then he tested well. But a guy like that, we've seen analogous guy. You know, I have my comp on him right now is Javon Hargrave. We see guys like this every year. You put him in a 3 technique right away. He that's what it is. He's going to attack the gaps and he's going to penetrate inside.
Yes.
Interior prep. Quarterbacks effing hate it.
Yep.
They in the NFL, they hate that more than from the outside because it blows it up right away and it speeds up their processing, whatever. You get a guy like Jerzan Newton to blow up the passing thing right off the bat. Yes. I'm just going to blow through that gap.
And I don't think he was all that healthy last year, and the snippets in his career when he was healthy, the dude was unstoppable. Okay,
it's unblockable
since,
for sure.
Since it's me and you, let's go ahead and have an Iowa section here real quick, and we'll finish this thing off. You already stole my thunder a little bit. All right, I have been kind of saying behind the scenes, and I don't know if I put it on Twitter so much because I don't feel it doesn't. No day feels like the day I want to get attacked by Iowa fans, but I'm going to make the bold statement on the podcast here. I love me some Cooper DeJean. I do. I wonder if he's more of a football player than he is pure cornerback, which then leads you to, does he wind up being safety? And of course, with the skin tone that he has, that's where all the conversation is at. This isn't a negative thing to say he maybe isn't a pure cover cornerback, but you see what I'm getting at here. Do you agree with me that he might be more of a slot in the box cornerback, safety? Do you think, you know, or is it as simple as he just needs to go to a zone heavy defense?
Yeah, so two-parter to the I'll hit the second one first. As far as the zone against the main thing, I think it's discussed a little bit too much with them, and one of the and not just him, with all the Iowa defensive backs that come out, and even the linebackers. You know, as you know, and we follow Iowa football very close. Iowa always has the awesome defense, and they run a lot of zone concepts. Iowa runs a lot of NFL concepts on both sides. It doesn't look as pretty sometimes on the other side of the ball, but in the NFL right now, you look at the percentages, it has gone way, way more to predominantly a zone-based league. There are instances, of course, of man coverage. The thing I'd say is, and Cooper, he had less of those reps than some of the other guys in the class, but look at the sample that he put out. It is really difficult to get away from Cooper, which, hey, man, what a shock that kid's a stud athlete. Throwing down dunks in high school and a ridiculous return man, and you can put him wherever you want on defense, which leads me to the other one about, you know, what position is he? I think the more instructive conversation than that about, like, you know, where should he be plugged in? I think the way he should be talked about, this is sort of my shtick with Brock Bowers. I don't call him a tight end. I call him an offensive weapon. There is the guys that came for several years, you know, we would call guys defensive chess piece. You know, there was like that era for like 3-4 years. Every class had the chess piece. And I think Isaiah Simmons killed it when he busted. It's like, okay, no one gets to be a defensive chess piece anymore. I would think of Cooper as a secondary chess piece.
Okay.
It's not you have to put him at one of these spots. It's he will be effective wherever he goes. We seen him last season. I mean, they had him 23 snaps in the slot, but he played a little bit more than that in the past.
Mm-hmm.
He had 630 on the boundary. Of course, he done more than that in the past. But they've even put him situationally, of course, they're loading up the box. They don't mind, and he don't mind.
Linebacker.
Put me on the edge if we're going to load this thing up. Yep. I'll get after somebody. He any phase of the game, I haven't seen one thing that he don't excel at. To the point, Jeff, where you know this, the only thing that we as Hawkeye fans really got upset about with regards to Coop over the last several years was the fact that they wouldn't put him on offense. And I think, you know, he suffered that little injury with the Italians at practice, and I think they were like, okay, no more of this.
Yep.
But they would have manufactured scores if they had put him on there. But anything, you want to send him on the blitz, he can do that. You want to put him in the slot situation, you can do that. Boundary, you want to do that, great. Free safety, you want to play him deep in center field, he is going to read the field probably better than anyone you've got with everything in front of him. He just sees the field so well. The IQ, you know, like Antoine Winfield. I'm going to see what's happening before it happens.
Yes.
You want to put him at strong, let's bring him up in the box and we'll have him be a banshee, you know, moving around, whatever. He can do it all. So that's the way that I think.
And that's you did a better job explaining my question in that that was no besmirching of Cooper DeJean's athletic ability. I'm so sad. It zapped my desire to follow the combine, because I would have loved to have seen a healthy Cooper run and test out.
For sure.
I think he would have blown people's minds with how well.
And he would have jumped out of the gym.
For sure. It's just, and what I think you just educated me on is I had made the hopefully erroneous assumption that a majority of NFL teams leave their corners out on an island and say, that's your job. If that's not as much of the case as what you're saying it is, that that makes my confidence in Cooper DeJean even higher as he moves into the NFL. Staying on the Iowa theme, I mean, you got to watch the right foot of God live at Reese's, at the Reese's senior camp. Iowa's Torrey Taylor. Yes, that's right, folks. We're talking about a punter. How high could he realistically get drafted? And probably already know the answer to this question, but is it worth it if he goes that high, however high it is?
Yeah, it was like seeing the Beatles when they were starting out. It was like seeing Mozart compose, up close. It was like seeing the guy that invented Bitcoin putting it out for the first time,
Right.
watching Torrey Taylor up close. That guy's ridiculous. Like he's got the leg strength, but that's not the thing that's ridiculous about him.
Can I
It's
ask
the
you this?
thing.
Were people at senior, were they like almost laughing? Like, oh my God, in awe. Like that's what I picture. I picture you and a bunch of dudes sitting in the stands, and he launches a punt or he drops another one inside the 3 yard line, where you guys are just sitting around. A respectful giggle, is what I'm saying. Am I creating the scene at all? Did that happen at the Senior Bowl?
After he had the whole field to himself. They were doing that thing where it was just like, they were at the 50 or whatever, and then there was nothing going on the other side of the field. It took the entire stadium probably three, four punts to catch on that it was just him
Okay.
doing it, but he was dropping everything inside the tent and it was just sticking, right? So
Insane.
it would just go, shoot up into the air, and it would always drop around the five, sometimes inside or sometimes six, seven, but it never went into the end zone and it never came back past the t I don't know what he
It's
does
fun,
with the spin
right?
and all. I'm not even gonna pretend to, but that it's more like pool or more like
Yes.
understanding of something like that. The
Ball
ball
room.
just like dies there when he wants it to die. It's like a trick shot guy. It is so impressive to watch in person. And he was like the one player there where like I got close to him and I was like, oh my God, like I could touch a future Hall of Famer
Right,
like right
right,
now. Like I am
right.
just so sky high on him. I just watch, I mean, they would use him and it's like, okay, field
Yep,
flipping,
yep.
opponent's about to be inside, stuck inside there at their 2 yard line. Like good luck with
So
your 98 yard drive.
do you think NFL GMs will see the value in that? Does he have a chance to go fourth round?
For sure. Yeah.
Okay.
In fact, if I had to bet, I would say fourth round. If you put me on like one round, and then I think probably the second best odds would be you probably have to go fifth, but
Okay.
then third best odds would be third.
Third.
I think
Insane.
there's better odds that he goes in the third than he goes in the, like if he
Amazing.
drops to the sixth round. I know it's a punter, but it's like,
But I tell you what,
hello.
and there's other punters in the NFL that can boom it, right? Tons of punters that can boom it. But the wizardry with dropping it is such, like, I think it's more
Insane.
rare. And I think that would be what where GMs would separate them. Last
I think he's
question.
going in the fourth. He's not going to
Fourth.
have to wait there long on Saturday.
Okay. For last question. Pick one out of the bag. A late round Big Ten player, any position that Thor Nystrom maybe likes more than most people.
Well, I'll answer that question while remaining on the Iowa theme.
Oh, okay.
I really like Eric All. Eric All, I think, is sort of criminally slept on, and it's a contextual thing, right? Because he got nicked up when he was at Michigan, then he transfers over with McNamara, then he suffers this season-ending injury last year. I believe when he did at the time when he got injured, even though it was, at the beginning of last year, McNamara even said this at the end of training camp. You remember that he had that interview and they asked him about his injury, and McNamara was like, next question, I'm not talking about that. And it was like, uh-oh, McNamara is still injured. Like this could end poorly. And then, so it was like McNamara not at 100%, and then he gets knocked out. Then Deacon Hill was in. Deacon Hill, I'll be
Yeah.
nice. He was not ready to throw at the Power Five level yet. That was who Eric All was working with when he got injured, though. I think he was number six or number seven in tight ends in the FBS in receiving yards, despite the offensive environment that he was in with this new team, et cetera. And you also saw this going back to Michigan. I think he's a way better athlete than people certainly coming into this process gave him credit for. And I think he's way more skilled as a pass catcher than he gets credit for as well. You don't want him back there blocking. It's not the way he was used in college, and you would never on a passing concept be like, Eric, stay back here to help us pass block. You want him out receiving. He is a super duper skill receiver. But like the guys coming into this process, you know, that are like in the final, you know, like there's a lot of guys that people loved Jaheim Bell, you know, is like a slot guy or the receiving dudes. I'm trying to find, like Ben Sinnott. I'm not crapping on Ben Sinnott, but I think Eric Gall is analogous, or I might even have Eric Gall ranked ahead of Ben Sinnott because I think he's a more skilled receiver. I just think contextually, because he got knocked out the past couple of years, he wasn't able to show, and then the offensive environment as well. I think if Eric Gall comes back to school next year, McNamara's healthy, I think he heads into the next class. Right. He's seen in a much better light, but I understand because of the elevated age and the context why he made the decision that he did. I think Eric Gall, though, is going to go higher than people think. This tight end class is not great. And so, like, you know, there's going to be a couple guys that the NFL likes more than sort of the public. If Eric Gall was not one of those couple names, I would be surprised. He's been slept on this process. Fantasy football guys out there, like if you're in your dynasty leagues, like late, you have fourth round, he'd be a guy like I'd pop like late. Okay. Yeah, like because he's one of the few guys in this class. Like you know, you have Bowers, of course, but you know I don't consider him a tight end. Jatavion Sanders, but then outside of that, you get into all the question marks. Theo Johnson's a good athlete, but the tape is inconsistent because they didn't let Drew Allar throw down the field. Maybe is one of the reasons. And, you know, then it's Sinnott and Wiley, and you know he's Brevin Spanford's just a third tackle. AJ Barner is just a blocking inline guy. Eric Gall is the guy who has receiving skill that could make a difference and stay on the field in the NFL as a receiver. Gotcha. So he's a guy I had to shout out.
And what's crazy is he was a one-time member of Michigan's class, Michigan class that could flirt potentially with being the most guys drafted. I know Harbaugh threw it out there. Do you think they'll come close to that record, or what's your thought there?
Yeah, I think they're going to break it. Wow. Yeah, I mean, I think that he was right. Yeah, and it's funny. Yeah, you have like if you start tossing in some of these guys that then left, and then you would toss it into that, it gets even more crazy. But it's a great contextual point. The guys that scouted him and brought him in, you're talking about one of the best tight end factories in college football, development and stuff like that. And then he transfers to the other one, right? So it's like two tight end U's, and that's where he came up. And it's the receiving skill with him and the utility. And that's something that the NFL values even more. You just get him out into the slot, and then you can also shift him around. And you're going to be able to use him as a receiver. And he's going to be productive in the NFL, I believe.
Well, Thor, I kept you longer than I said I would. I do that every single time. But let the big Eyes on Big audience know where they can find you. I'm sure most of them already follow you on Twitter, but what throw it out there.
You can find me on Fantasy Bros, Betting Pros, do shows on Score North, Viking centric draft stuff, and Twitter is ThorKU. I think that covers it.
All right, thank you so much, Thor, for joining the Eyes on Big podcast. This is Jeffrey the Greek for Big Kurt and Jordan Engelson. We will talk to you soon.